This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we have, I think, a very, very germane broadcast for this time of year because, well, it's been a long, cold winter, and finally we've emerged into the beautiful sunshine, but with late spring and summer comes a host of hazards. In particular, these days people are concerned about ticks. Tick-borne disease is a source of lots of illness across the country and across the world. Virtually no matter where you are, you have to be concerned about it. I'm located here in the Northeast, which is the epicenter of the Lyme disease epidemic, but we have patients virtually in all 50 states in the United States, in Canada, in Europe, throughout the world. So today we've invited an expert. I've actually spoken to her in the past during the previous incarnation of this program when it was called Intelligent Medicine. She is Dr. Harriet Katsouris. She's the chief scientific officer of something called the Global Lyme Alliance. That's the nation's largest Lyme and tick-borne disease organization dedicated to research and education. She is a neurologist. She's board certified in internal medicine and neurology. And until recently, she maintained a private neurology practice in Stamford, Connecticut, close to Lyme, Connecticut, which is where this whole epidemic first started. It was actually fairly recently discovered a few decades ago, located in Lyme, Connecticut. She's also a graduate of Barnard College, my Columbia College sister school, and she received her MD from the University of Rochester School of Medicine. She did her residencies in internal medicine and neurology and psychiatry at New York Hospital, which is now Cornell. So as Global Lyme Alliance's chief scientific officer, Dr. Katsouris is heading the organization's scientific advisory board, and part of their mandate is to award grants to researchers at top universities across the country who are working on critically needed Lyme and tick-borne disease research projects, which we're going to talk about in just a few moments. But before we get to that, let's get some Lyme disease basics. Welcome, Dr. Katsouris.
Thank you.
Well, so first of all, give us a little background on this. You know, as I said, this is something that was unrecognized until it was discovered, I guess, was it in the 1970s, 1980s?
That's right, late 70s, early 80s. That's correct. So we've been doing this for about over three decades.
Right. So give us the scope of the problem. You know, some people think that Lyme disease, you know, sort of an infrequent occurrence. But I looked at the statistics that the Lyme research, the Global Lyme Alliance compiled, and they're quite stunning.
That's right. Lyme disease was initially thought to be juvenile rheumatoid arthritis in young children up in the Lyme, Connecticut area, and was brought to pass that after studying at Yale, Dr. Alan Steer recognized that there were a cluster of cases and felt that it was it went beyond that, and Dr. Willie Bergdorfer found that it was related to a spirochete, an infection by a spirochete transmitted by a tick bite known as Borrelia burgdorferi, that in fact a Lyme disease was an infectious illness. And everything took off from there.
So, and that we actually call it burgdorferi. It was given the scientific name, named after Willie Bergdorfer. So relatively a new disease, a poorly understood disease. And so it's not so simple a matter as, okay, you get bit by a tick And then you recognize that, and then you go to a doctor and you appropriately get antibiotics, and all is well. There are several ways that this can go horribly wrong.
That's correct. The misconception is that Lyme disease is easy to diagnose and easy to treat. But in fact, it's difficult to diagnose and difficult to treat, simply because of several things. And number one, the diagnostic tests readily available today are based on indirect analysis, based on the patient being able to mount an adequate antibody response to the organism that can be detected in a blood test. These blood tests are at best maybe 60% accurate.
So in other words, it's conceivable that someone who comes in with the aches and the pains and the malaise and weird neurological symptoms, they test negative, but there should still be a high clinical suspicion that maybe we're missing the boat here.
That's correct. Very much like syphilis at the turn of the century, Lyme disease is also a great imitator, and it can present as a flu-like illness. Can present with a myriad of signs and symptoms that can confound any clinician trying to make a diagnosis, especially when they cannot obtain an adequate history of the characteristic rash or obtain a positive blood test. So many of these patients, it's not unheard of that these patients go from doctor to doctor and they see a dozen doctors or more before they're appropriately diagnosed and then treated.
So, excuse me, you mentioned the bullseye rash, and I think a lot of people know what that looks like. It's, like a pale area with a concentric red, like a target, like a bullseye.
That's correct.
It's absolutely, pathognomonic. In other words, typical of Lyme disease, a dead giveaway. How often do you actually see that in a case of Lyme disease?
Less than half.
Okay.
Many patients may actually have the rash, but it may be on a part of the body that they can't see on their own.
Right.
That's the other problem. And also, there have been a few studies that point out that this typical bullseye rash may actually not be the typical rash, that an expanding annular or ring-like rash may be a much better descriptive term for the type of rash associated with Lyme disease infection.
No, so it may be solid, but expanding, like just a red rash that gets bigger?
Red blotch, right.
A blotch, mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, misdiagnosis is a spider bite.
Uh-huh, okay. So, all right. So let's say, a person gets bit by a tick, finds the tick, because that's, that's a dead giveaway that you've got a potential problem. Always give antibiotics right away?
That's controversial.
People used to bring in the tick. I would get these little plastic baggies, and people say, could you please send this tick to the lab so I know whether I need to get treatment? And it would be like, maybe you should just get treatment in case.
Right. A couple of things. Not all ticks carry Lyme disease. In our area right now, my understanding is that about a third of the ticks carry Borrelia burgdorferi, the causative organism of Lyme, and about 3% are carrying a co-infection known as babesiosis or Babesia microti, which is a malarial-type illness that affects the red blood cells and causes a hemolytic anemia-type picture and also a flu-like illness-type picture, very serious illness. Some communities may not be set up to accept these ticks for analysis. Greenwich, Connecticut, where we are primarily based at this point in time, does have that set up where you can bring ticks in for analysis, and I believe they go up to the Connecticut Agricultural Center where they're analyzed.
So it depends on where you are, and Greenwich being pretty close to the epicenter of this whole thing. They've got the facilities. Other places, not. I noticed that some doctors go right ahead and dose people with antibiotics if there's even a question of a tick bite. Is that overzealous?
Maybe, maybe not. It all depends. I mean, if someone presents with an annular rash, a ring-like rash in an endemic area, I don't think anybody would say that a standard course of antibiotics was wrong. What to do with a simple tick bite, that say, for example, a tick bite where the tick is not even engorged, is difficult to say. There have been some studies that suggest that 100 milligrams of doxycycline for twice a day for four doses may prevent the onset or the development of Lyme disease.
Like a preventive dose.
Again, preventive dose. That's never been quite accepted by all of the scientific community.
It's kind of like what you do for an AIDS needle stick, like a preventive, you know, mm-hmm. so like a high dose for a few days, and that should get it, but it, you know, may or may not.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. And apropos of what I was saying before, easy to diagnose, easy to treat, even if one were to treat in an adequate meaning 3 to 4 weeks of, say, for example, doxycycline, 100 milligrams twice a day, and in a timely fashion, there is still a significant treatment failure rate that we recognize, anywhere from 10 to 20% that can go on to develop chronic Lyme disease.
And the magnitude of this problem has been underestimated. It's comparable to, you know, I saw a statistic where it's comparable to the breast cancer epidemic.
Numerically, the number of cases. Totally underestimated at first. Now cases may number up to 300,000 new cases per year, and even that, given the limitations of our diagnostic testing, could be even higher. Could be 400,000 to 450,000 new cases per year. And if you do the math and say that even if these patients do end up in physicians' hands where they're adequately treated, you still go on for a 10 to 20% failure rate, start to do the math, you see how your situation with chronic or post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome patients can grow over time. And this is an incredible burden, both to the medical community and to the economy.
So here's where the controversy lies. There is this entity called post-Lyme syndrome, mm-hmm. whereby someone gets tested, appropriately treated for Lyme disease. Some people do great, but the majority of people, you know, have a limited infection. They recover fine. Caught early enough, not such a big problem. But a significant percentage, you say 20%? I'm not sure that's what you said.
Yeah.
But a high percentage of people. I'm sorry?
Yeah. I was going to say somewhere between 10 to 20% based on some studies that we actually have funded down at Johns Hopkins have shown that quite clearly.
Right. So the controversy is this. I mean, there are many controversies. You probably can shed light on them. But one of the controversies is, okay, these people have been sick and they've gotten sometimes multiple rounds of antibiotics and they're still sick. So what's going on with them? Do they have Lyme disease that's very hard to treat? Do they need more antibiotics or sometimes combinations of antibiotics given perhaps intravenously to eradicate their very resistant bug? Or are they suffering the aftermath of Lyme, which is gone? You know, much as sometimes people after a bad infection, say meningitis or dengue fever, they feel sick and debilitated for a long period of time afterwards, like a post-viral syndrome. Post-infectious encephalitis, or, you know, whatever name you might give to it.
That's right. Absolutely correct. I think the jury is still out on this. This could end up one day being viewed as being multifactorial. There is a school of thought that patients do not resolve completely because of the nature of the bacterium forming what would they call persisters. Antibiotic-tolerant bacteria that go dormant and hide in the tissue only to reactivate and cause symptoms at a later date, either under situations of stress, another infection, or another illness or a vaccine or something along those lines. The other school of thought is that it's an autoimmune or an immunological type of response. It may be in some genetically predisposed individuals where their body gets confused and makes antibodies. That is, their immune system starts to attack their natural tissue, whether it be in the joints, muscles, heart, nerve cells, etc.
It kindles kind of an autoimmune disease. That's
correct.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a combination of a few things.
Right.
We don't know.
Right. And there's certainly, like, patients are debilitated. They may have multiple things wrong with them. They may have hormonal problems. They may have nutritional issues. They may have indeed they may have psychological issues from being sick and tired for so long.
Right.
Although it's not all in their heads, but that may be a complicating factor. So this is the nature of the research that you're undertaking. How to better detect Lyme disease, how to come up with better tests, how to determine if a person has been successfully treated for Lyme disease, whether they really need more antibiotics, which antibiotics indeed are effective, or perhaps there are other therapies that might help to bring about resolution of their symptoms.
Yes, we at Global Lyme Alliance have funded all of these types of projects because we do need a better diagnostic test. That would at least allow patients to be treated perhaps in a more timely fashion so that the treatment failure rate may be cut in hopefully to a very small percentage. We also are looking at the immune system, and we're also looking at biomarkers, things floating in the bloodstream that might indicate the level of inflammation or infection in the body so that it gives the clinician treating the patient a better idea as to endpoint of antibiotic treatment. Because right now, all we have to go on is how does the patient feel?
Right.
And it's not particularly clear that more antibiotics are better. We may need a different modality of treatment, maybe not antibiotics, maybe something that modulates the immune system.
Or right. In other words, when to hold and when to fold. When to hold and when
That's
to fold.
Right.
Because, I mean, clearly, there are extremes of viewpoints on this. There are some doctors who say, look, Lyme disease, I'll only diagnose it if the patient has a serology and a Western blot that meets these criteria. You say that test is not accurate entirely, but they're very conservative. They don't, they'll say, if that, you don't meet the criteria, you don't have Lyme disease, no antibiotics for you, like the soup Nazi in Seinfeld. And then there are doctors who are the so-called Lyme literate doctors, some of whom are very aggressive, and will continue to treat patients with very, very aggressive antibiotic regimes. And we know that antibiotics are not entirely benign. They can cause long-term side effects. And so, who's right? Where does the answer lie?
That's right. And that's what we're trying to find out. We're trying to get more answers for the patients who, let's face it, are the ones who are suffering and have, in some instances, the functional level of patients with severe congestive heart failure. It's been compared to patients in that particular type of clinical category. And also the cost to the economy has been in the billions each year for patients with severe and chronic Lyme disease.
Now, the problem, like you say, is Lyme disease is the great masquerader. And what ends up happening sometimes is that, you get an aging population where people feel lousy. They have malaise. They have brain fog. They have joint pain. And sometimes that looks a lot like Lyme disease. They might have multiple sclerosis, or they might have Lou Gehrig's disease or Alzheimer's disease. How do you know that they're not suffering from some sort of infection?
You don't know 100%. That's absolutely true. You try to do as many ancillary tests, extra tests that you can do that might implicate an infection. And then, of course, there is a school of thought that says that every disease has had an infectious basis to begin with, that something, a viral or a bacterial infection or whatever, has triggered some illness down the line. There are a lot of people who feel that that is the case. Apropos of things like post-infectious encephalomyelitis, or some people feel that MS could have been due to a viral illness early on in life. There are a lot of schools of thought along those lines.
So a new scourge that is scaring the heck out of a lot of people who like to go out in nature and into the woods is this new entity called the Powassan virus. Am I getting that right? You are sort of an expert on that. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I don't know if I'm an expert on it, but we recognize that it has been increasingly found in ticks in this area. Now, again, you may say 2 to 4%. Oh, that doesn't sound like a whole heck of a lot. But ticks in the Bridgeport and Branford areas of Connecticut have been found to carry powassan. In the past, let's go back. There have been about 60-some-odd cases of powassan virus in the northern hemisphere over the last, 50 or so years. So not a lot. It was first described up in Ontario, Canada. A young boy developed this. It's an encephalomyelitis. It's a brain infection, very much like St. Louis encephalitis and those other viral encephalitides. And it is transmitted by the same tick that transmits Lyme disease. And the numbers of ticks carrying powassan has increased. Powassan, unfortunately, unlike Borrelia burgdorferi, the causative organism for Lyme, can be transmitted within 15 minutes of a tick bite. With Lyme disease, the school of thought is that it's got to be on your body for a lot longer, and transmission time really depends on the tick being engorged and being able to transmit the Borrelia burgdorferi.
In other words, it's actually the timing is important, because if you see a tick on your body and it just latched on, if you can get it off before it spends a lot of time in proximity, you can minimize your chance of getting an infection, but not when it comes to the virus. The virus is more rapidly transmitted. Okay.
More rapidly transmitted, 15 minutes. And unfortunately, there's about a 10% fatality rate, and over half of the patients are left with some type of neurological sequela.
Wow.
And you get fever, headache, seizures, confusion, everything and anything that goes along with a brain infection. And there is no specific treatment other than supportive treatment. Fluids, medication to keep your blood pressure up if it starts to fall, medication to reduce brain swelling, airway protection with an endotracheal tube if you have trouble breathing, if you should lapse into a coma, things like that. It's a very, very serious illness.
Wow. It sounds like... after hearing this, a lot of people are going to want to stay inside on the sofa and watch, binge watch Mad Men or Game of Thrones this summer instead of going into the woods. All right. So good introduction to the topic of Lyme disease, but there's much more to this. And we're going to talk about co-infections. We're going to talk about testing. And we're going to talk about how to find a Lyme-literate physician who will actually listen to your symptoms and not just do blood tests. And we'll look at some of the new research on the frontier of Lyme disease and tick-borne illness treatment. Today's guest is Dr. Harriet Katsouris. And Dr. Katsouris is the chief scientific officer of something called the Global Lyme Alliance. We'll tell you a little bit about that excellent organization in part two. So stay with us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.